What is up, Bitcoiners? Welcome back to FedWatch. A little bit different episode today. Christian is traveling for work, and I was like, I need to do an episode because there's so much going on with Evergrande. I want to talk about it again, and Bitcoin, of course. So this fits right into what FedWatch does. So yes, speaking of Evergrande, it's starting to make its way into mainstream financial press. We have been talking about it since episode 60 on August 11th. I'm going to share this screen. So on episode 60, at minute 28, if you want, guys want to go and listen to that, I give all of my factors at that time why I think that in the next 3 months, at that time in August, China was going to see a recession. And 6 weeks later, it looks like there's a recession coming. On that episode, I also used this tweet thread by Last Bear Standing, where he is talking about Evergrande. He or she tweeted this on July 20th. So Evergrande was out there in the very niche space of macro, but nobody really was talking about it, especially in Bitcoin. We were the first podcast in Bitcoin to talk about it. And we were the first macro podcast or sound money, gold bug, Bitcoin podcast to talk about a specific time frame of within 3 months. And 6 weeks later, here we are. So what's going on with Evergrande? Now remember, Evergrande has $300 billion in bad debt, and it's slowly maturing. This Thursday is the big day where a lot of it matures, and they're going to have a major default event, which people are expecting. And that's one reason why the price of their bonds has gone down so much. I mean, you can buy them at like 20 cents on the dollar now. That is a significant discount. So they are not the largest real estate company by any means. They are the second largest. And maybe they were the largest back in 2019, but since they've started having problems, they have now they're pretty much tied for second. And then their Country Garden, which is about 10% larger. And we're talking roughly, let's see, they have Evergrande has 700 billion yuan in revenue in 2020. So that equates to a little bit over $100 billion in revenue. So that's the size we're talking about. And they have $300 billion in bad debt. Now, if they are forced to liquidate, right? If they're forced to liquidate all these apartments, all this land that they have, all these assets, and the price dives, what's going to happen to these other large development companies? Well, their assets are going to go down in value, and they're going to become insolvent as well. And you know that's how the contagion spreads. And then who owns that debt? Who owns the debt that Evergrande's not going to pay? Well, is it Western pension funds? Is it Western hedge funds? Who has this debt? Who is going to also get liquidated when this debt goes down or turns worthless, basically? So that's how the contagion spreads throughout the economy. Okay, what else do we got here? I wanted to just show the rise in debt to GDP because one reason why I could call this next 3 months or this being bearish on China, where everyone else seemed to be bullish on China, like the Thucydides trap and other things, which we'll get into here in a little bit. The reason why I was able to be bearish and it looks like it's going to turn out that way is because of this China debt problem. Now, this chart is from Deutsche Bank that I'm sharing here, showing about 275% debt to GDP, which puts it over Japan's official number, which is supposed to be the most indebted, but it looks like China is the most indebted here. And I don't buy this central government number. It's very small, like about 10% of GDP, which I don't think that's the case. So if you add it on, their government debt on top of this, it puts it over 300%, up to 350%. I've seen people talking about the debt to GDP for China. And this is just, I mean, they went from 100% of GDP to 350% of debt to GDP in 20 years. So this is the largest, quickest debt bubble that the world has ever seen. And that is the context in which I can say, okay, well, they're having all these issues. There's a slowdown, there's bad supply chains, there is now real estate problems in China. So things are coming to a head very, very quickly. And I, of course, then my geopolitical position or opinion on top of that is that China will shrink over the next few decades while the U.S. continues to grow. So that is the context in which I made this call. All right. Let me stop sharing for a second. So much easier with the host. I'm trying to do this all in one shot, one recording. So we'll see if I trip over my words or what happens. But okay, so people are calling this Lehman, and I think it's bigger than that, actually. It's more systemic for China itself. It might not be a bigger global event, and we'll get into why that is, but I think it's bigger and worse for China than Lehman was for the U.S. 70% of people's personal savings or household savings is in real estate. More second homes are sold than first homes, and the same amount of third homes are sold as first homes. So you can see how, you know, people, that's how they save. They save by buying homes. And there's lots of people buying lots of multiple properties. And that's how you get ghost cities. So we've talked about this. This is kind of, you know, people talked about it and it was poo-pooed as a rumor, a myth, anti-China about these ghost cities going up. But there were ghost cities, or there are ghost cities. These large developments, entire cities built for 1 million+ people, waiting for somebody to move in, and nobody moves in. All right, that speaks to this whole idea. It summarizes all of the Chinese economy, right? It's just a big credit bubble. It also speaks to the Belt and Road Initiative. A lot of people are like, oh, but what about the Belt and Road Initiative? They're going in and making friends with people and funding these ports and roads and infrastructure in these other countries. Central Asia is getting a road that's going to connect China with Europe. Okay. But it's just like these ghost cities. If you build it, they will come. Most likely not. Right? Capitalism works from demand first. First comes demand, then comes the infrastructure, then comes the build out. You can't just centrally plan these things to say, we are going to build a 1 million person city. We're going to build a port that can handle hundreds of vessels every week in a place that doesn't need it, right? That is exactly how China is. To sum up the Chinese economy, is just overproduction, overcapacity, and they were hoping that demand would follow, right? And it really hasn't. So anyway, what else do we have? So here's one of the differences with Lehman as well, okay? So China, you might have heard the term capitalism with Chinese characteristics or socialism with Chinese characteristics. You see it both ways. This became very, very popular. China became very, very popular for Western academics and Western socialists to use as an example of the way communism can work, the way socialism can work. You know, socialists are constantly saying, you know, oh, that just wasn't the right version of communism. That's why it failed in Venezuela. That's why it failed in the Soviet Union. That's why Cuba is such a disaster, because that's just not the right kind of communism. And then they looked at China, and China seems to be doing very, very well as a one-party communist system. And that became very popular with academics. One of the kind of symbols of this was the idea of Thucydides' trap. And I did a whole episode on my other podcast, Bitcoin and Markets, episode number 225 from 6 months ago or so, debunking the Thucydides trap. That is an idea that was picked up very quickly by Western academics about a rising power versus a declining power, and how China is rising and the US is declining, and how there's inevitable conflict there. And we were even seeing some trade wars and seeing some conflict over the last few years. And so it seemed like the Thucydides trap was correct, but I debunked that and I say, no, this is, China is not rising. It's just a big ass credit bubble, right? And it's gonna collapse. So anyway, but that idea was very popular with academics, and you can see why, because they're waiting for something to validate their political beliefs about communism and about socialism.
All right, Bitcoiners, I want to tell you about our newest sponsor. This show is brought to you by Ledin.io. I have been super, super impressed with the guys over at Ledin. I've actually known the co-founders, Adam and Maurizio, for a very long time. I've had the pleasure to watch them build Ledin up from a tiny, tiny startup to now a super impressive institutional grade Bitcoin and crypto lender. Y'all, I'm so impressed with these guys. They are offering some of the best rates out there. I don't think anyone even comes close to touching them. You can get 6.1% APY on your first two Bitcoin that you deposit into Ledin interest accounts, and you can get 8.5% on USDC deposits. I mean, I know all the competitors. They're not even close. If you're going to put your crypto and your Bitcoin into an interest account, Ledin is by far the best. And on top of that, like I said, these guys are hardcore Bitcoiners and they know the products and the services that Bitcoiners want and appreciate. They came up with B2X. It allows you to put your Bitcoin in, they leverage it up, and you can, with one click of the mouse, get twice the exposure to Bitcoin. So if you're super bullish, Ledin has you covered with a super, super easy way to get leverage with B2X. And then on top of that, they know that Bitcoiners care about your reserves. They know that Bitcoiners don't like under-reserved and not full-reserved financial institutions. So they are pushing the frontier in transparency in the digital asset lending space. And they are the first digital asset lender to do a full proof of reserves and proof of attestation through a Mariano LLC, a public accounting firm. So the Ledin guys, they know what Bitcoin is like. They are legit. I encourage you guys to check them out. Do your own research and go to Ledin.io. That is Ledin.io and learn more. Bitcoiners, I want to tell you about The Deep Dive. The Deep Dive is Bitcoin Magazine's premium market intelligence newsletter. This is a no-fluff, hard-hitting, incredible newsletter going deep into the market, helping you understand what's happening with derivatives, what's happening on-chain, what's happening in macro, what's happening with the narrative, and what's happening with the tech. My man, Dylan LeClaire, is an absolute savant. He is making his name known in the Bitcoin community, getting shout-outs left and right, getting on podcasts left and right, and him and his team are bringing you everything that you need to know about Bitcoin. You don't even have to be on Bitcoin Twitter. You can ignore every other newsletter. This is the newsletter to rule them all. Go over to members.bitcoinmagazine.com, sign up today. And if you use promo code MACRO, you get a full month for free. You have nothing to lose. What are you waiting for? Sign up, see the incredible work that Dylan and his team are putting out. And if you don't like it, just unsubscribe. You don't pay a dime. But if you do, you know, it's going to be well worth the sats in investment in understanding Bitcoin and gaining the confidence to continue to invest in Bitcoin and making the right moves around Bitcoin. And it's going to be well worth every single Satoshi. Again, can't recommend it enough. That is members.bitcoinmagazine.com, promo code MACRO. Do it today.
How does this tie into the situation with Evergrande? Well, Evergrande is happening during what I call the second communist revolution in China. So if people are familiar with Marxism, it's a process. You know, the communist revolution is a process. So first you have capitalism, and capitalism creates wealth and creates capital and infrastructure and all of this stuff. It gets to a point where the income inequality is so great that the workers rebel, and then the worker sees the means of production and you get a communist paradise. That is the process. So communism does have room for capitalism, or at least Marxism has room for capitalism. It's a requirement, actually. And I think the Chinese saw that back in the 70s when they were deciding to open up. They said, well, look, we never had this capitalistic phase where we could build up this infrastructure to seize. We just seized it. We just seized everything. And that's why we had the Great Leap Forward, the failures of the Great Leap Forward, where 60 million people, I think, or more than that, I don't know how many exactly, died in China. It was a huge, probably the worst failure in the history of the world for killing of your own citizens. It was this Great Leap Forward. And so they probably blamed it on, like, hey, we didn't have this capitalistic phase to build up this capital to seize. So we need to do that now. So they reinstated, they opened up, and they have this capitalism or socialism with Chinese characteristics. But now that capitalism has played itself out, and Xi Jinping and others now see this as a end of the capitalistic process, now back towards seizing the means of production. So I think we see this big crackdown on all of this stuff over there in China as part of this second communist revolution. Now, if you put Evergrande in that context, that's what we're talking about here. It's different from Lehman. Lehman was a interconnected financial crisis, but not in a broader context of a second communist revolution. So this is very scary for China and for Chinese people. And the region. I mean, drowning people are very dangerous because they'll grab onto you and pull you under, right? So the neighbors of China, I would be very worried about a flailing communist party. Anyway, you see things like crackdown on fintech companies, tech companies like Didi, which is the Chinese Uber, IPOs, not only in China, but in foreign exchanges like the New York Stock Exchange, the over $1 trillion education industry for like private tutors and private lessons, especially English and other things, private schools. It has been nationalized for the most part into nonprofit. So they changed all profit-oriented education businesses into nonprofit. You see a crackdown on entertainment. So now kids cannot play more than 3 hours of video games every week. They're also cracking down on celebrities. They don't want feminine celebrities. If you think of K-pop that has, you know, more feminine boys or men, that was becoming popular in China as well. And so they said, we don't want this feminine men as celebrities. So they're cracking down on that. And of course, this all started with Hong Kong. They seized Hong Kong, got rid of the one country, two systems or whatever they called it. So they got rid of that, cracked down on democracy and freedom of speech in Hong Kong. And that was like the first step in all of these dominoes that are falling. And now that puts Evergrande at the end of this domino line. And a lot of people are saying that Evergrande was planned, or that Evergrande was, they're not stopping it because they want it to happen. And I don't think it was planned, but I think they could see it. And yeah, maybe they're not stopping it because they want to change. These big ideas to understand are malinvestment and misallocation. Malinvestment is just where you don't get your money back on your investment, right? You invested $1,000 and you lost money on the deal. Now, misallocation is where over a period of time, well, if it's an individual, can misallocate as well, but we're talking about this on a country or economy-wide scale. Over time, money flows into sectors that it otherwise wouldn't have except for some sort of intervention. So the price signals are skewed, and that creates an incentive to invest in the wrong sectors, to build up these wrong sectors. And as more money goes there, then you have returns there, more money flows there because there's higher returns. And it's all driven off of faulty signals that were not part of the free market. And so that's what misallocation is. And over the decades, your whole entire economy can be shifted. The capital structure of your whole entire economy can be shifted. So that's very troubling and very important to understand about this idea of the real estate bubble in China. I think what they are trying to do is the Chinese Communist Party, they want to change into a consumption-led economy. This gets into the middle income trap idea. So they are stuck in the middle income trap, and that is where poor countries start out as manufacturing, low skill, low paid manufacturing. But that slowly builds up capital in the country, infrastructure, wages grow, income grows, per capita GDP grows, and you become a middle income country. And then the trick is to somehow turn that, because you're no longer a low-cost producer anymore. You're a middle-cost producer, and you're trying to transition your economy into being a service-led economy, a consumption-led economy. And that almost never has happened. That's why it's called the middle-income trap. Now, a lot of people thought China would be able to get out of that or to solve it, but right now, it doesn't seem to be that way. The big thing is, over decades of misallocation, of this credit boom into property, they can't deflate it without collapsing. So they're stuck in this rigid capital structure that puts money towards real estate. And the only way to like get rid of this, to reallocate the capital, is to let it collapse. So I don't think that there's going to be a bailout directly of these real estate investment companies. It's going to be very painful for the people. But I think there's going to be bailouts on the second layer, which would be the banks. The banks are who are owed money by these big real estate developers. And so I think they will get bailed out. There might even be consumer bailouts or, you know, household bailouts. We'll see how that goes. But I think these large companies are not going to get bailed out. Okay, what about contagion for the rest of the world? There are a few Western investment funds or large entities that are trying to help and save this, because the Chinese economy or Chinese government doesn't seem to be wanting to save Evergrande. So large companies like HSBC, UBS, and BlackRock are buying up this Evergrande debt at 20 cents, 25 cents on the dollar, saying it's a good deal. So they're trying to save it. We'll see how successful they can be. But I do link to a story about that in the show notes for you guys. I think they're ending up throwing good money after bad, which could spread contagion, right? Who owns this debt? Well, BlackRock. Who has money there? Well, other large funds, high net worth individuals, etc. And on and on. Who else is going to get screwed by Evergrande's default? Well, maybe pension funds. You know, that's how it spreads. But I do think that there's going to be less contagion internationally than what some people expect. I think of this kind of like, okay, in 2008-09, we had the great financial crisis. Then in 2010-11, we had the European debt crisis. And I think this could be something similar to that, because the European debt crisis was very centered in Europe. I mean, the whole global economy kind of slowed down, but the main crisis was focused in the European, the Eurozone. And so I think that's going to be similar. Most of the crisis is going to be contained within China, with a global slowdown around that. The US is going to be fairly insulated, along with other countries like France is one that comes to mind, but it's going to be a mixed bag around the world. For example, Germany is much more exposed to international trade. Around 25% of their GDP comes from trade outside of the Eurozone, where France is only 10%. And the US is only 10%. So it's going to be a mixed bag of which countries, which will be more hurt by a global slowdown, a decline in the amount of globalization and trade route shortening. Yeah, it's going to be a mixed bag. But I do expect it to be similar to the European debt crisis in 2010, 2011. Now, what does this have to say about inflation? You guys know I'm pretty much the only deflationist in Bitcoin, maybe Jeff Booth, but we are for different reasons why we are deflationists. And it's important to understand that supply chains are not money printing. Like, problems with supply chains, price increases due to supply chain issues is not money printing. And when we talk about inflation, we're talking about money printing. We're talking about the supply of money. Has the supply of money gone up? Now, you can look at M2 and say, okay, it's quadrupled in the last 10 years. But prices have not quadrupled. And I don't care what anecdotes you want to look at, what numbers you want to look at, prices have not quadrupled like M2 has. It has gone up maybe 5, 10% in some things. CPI is showing 5% year on year, but it has not quadrupled. So M2 is not a measure of money supply. If it were, prices would have quadrupled. We see gas prices going down over the decade. But right now, they're just over $3 per gallon in the US. And back at the Great Financial Crisis, for the next few years after the Great Financial Crisis, it was $4 a gallon. So prices have come down. You cannot rely on anecdotes and surveys. So people notice, we're hardwired to notice scarcity. We're hardwired to notice price increases. We're not hardwired to notice price decreases. So for every 10% that the price goes up, it's going to fall 10% as well. But we just don't notice the the declines in prices. But if you look around, like I did this on the last episode of FedWatcher, if you look around at commodities and stuff, the trend is down since the Great Financial Crisis. Prices go up and prices come down.
Bitcoiners, I am so excited to tell you about the Bitcoin 2022 conference. You guys, Bitcoin 2021 was absolutely a smash hit success. It was over 13,000 Bitcoiners coming together, breaking the barriers on who can come together and celebrate freedom, celebrate Bitcoin, and the energy was absolutely electric. Unfortunately, it was just oversubscribed. There's just people flowing out everywhere. And this year, we are learning. We are making the conference bigger and better. We are moving over to the Miami Beach Convention Center, and we are going to be throwing a massive four-day festival for Bitcoin, celebrating Bitcoin, bringing together the greatest minds in Bitcoin and the greatest businesses in Bitcoin. And lastly, the culture of Bitcoin all together. We have a four-day extravaganza planned for you guys for Bitcoin 2022. Day one is going to be industry day. It is a day where you can buy a special ticket in order to just mingle and make business deals happen. Day two and three is going to be a full-blown Bitcoin conference. This is our main conference. This is going to be on April 7th and 8th. And then lastly, we have the Sound Music Festival day four. Imagine going to Coachella, but for Bitcoin. There's going to be very few talks. It's going to be all about the culture of Bitcoin. It's going to be all about hanging with your fellow plebs. And it's going to be an absolutely amazing time. There's going to be Bitcoin musicians, Bitcoin artists, and all your favorite Bitcoiners, and just an amazing environment to party and just see it all, soak it all in, and to get people to realize that a Bitcoin world, a world filled with Bitcoin people doing Bitcoin things, is the world that they want to live in. That's what Bitcoin 2022 is all about. That is what the Bitcoin conference is all about. That's what Bitcoin magazine is all about. So it is going to be a celebration of Bitcoin, the Bitcoiners, and this amazing movement that is going to make the world a better place. Go to b.tc/conference. Learn more about the Bitcoin conference. Learn more about all the amazing things that are happening in Miami around the Bitcoin conference and buy your tickets. And guess what? If you buy your tickets with Bitcoin, you save $100 on all the tickets and $1,000 on the whale pass. So if you want the VIP pass, the big kahuna, if you buy with Bitcoin, you save $1,000. That's a lot of sats. So go and do it right now today. Don't wait. Prices are only going up. This is going to be a can't miss event. Bitcoiners, let's take a break from the content. And I want to tell you about Coolbix. Coolbix is an awesome Bitcoin hardware wallet that's been around for a really long time. They are building an amazing Bitcoin wallet called the Cool Wallet Pro. The Cool Wallet Pro is state of the art Bitcoin hardware wallet technology. Its form factor is like a credit card. You can put it into your wallet and it is designed to go with you on the go. So that way, even when you're on the go, you can have the benefit of a two-factor hardware wallet design when you're trying to spend your Bitcoin. So you can have your Bitcoin wallet UX on your phone and make it really easy to scan, decide what you want to do, but then you sign with a Coolbit X, which is in your back pocket. It is tamper-proof. It is waterproof. It is flexible. It has an awesome secure element in it. And it is a really awesome way in order to have some more flexibility, yet security when you're taking your Bitcoin on the go. I personally am a fan of this idea of making Bitcoin into a medium of exchange and making it into something that people use. I know it's going to take time, but they are working on the UX for making that possible in as secure a way possible. So have some peace of mind. Check out the Cool Wallet Pro from Coolbix, and thank you to them for sponsoring this podcast.
M2 is not money. It's not money supply. Supply chain issues will cause prices to go up, but that's not money printing. All right. Enough on that. So what does Evergrande have to do with effects on Bitcoin? Well, my big thing is that Bitcoin is a good investment in deflationary times and inflationary times. Everybody is so centered and focused on inflation of money printing that is their whole thesis for Bitcoin, is that there's going to be hyperinflation because of quantitative easing or whatever. That's not money printing, and Bitcoin's still going up regardless. Bitcoin, if you look at like a 2-year moving average on the dollar versus Bitcoin, they go up together. They're positively correlated on a long enough time frame. And I think that will continue. I think the dollar will strengthen and so will Bitcoin. Why is that? Well, Bitcoin doesn't have counterparty risk. So in a credit-based system that we have now where money is debt and most of your assets are someone else's liability, if there is collateral that, or if there's assets that are become impaired through, you know, a bank going insolvent or a company going insolvent or some sort of supply chain issues or Evergrande, if there is some sort of impairment in that asset, the price will crash. So most assets are someone else's liability, but Bitcoin is counterparty, has no counterparty risk if you hold your own keys. You can't have someone default and wipe out your Bitcoin. I mean, that Bitcoin will be owned by somebody. There's no counterparty risk. This is the same argument with gold, except gold has inflation risk. Not only is there 1% to 2% new gold mined every year, which degrades, undermines the value of your holdings, but there is a possibility that they could, an asteroid could crash into the earth and have double the gold supply. Or maybe there's a big, rich new mine discovered, deposit of gold, and it doubles the world's gold supply in a matter of a decade. That is a risk where Bitcoin doesn't have that risk. So Bitcoin is, has less counterparty risk, less risk in general of being debased. But yes, that is the reason I believe that Bitcoin will go up, because it is counterparty, because of the lack of the counterparty risk. And it's important to think about Bitcoin's investment thesis in a deflationary environment versus only ever thinking about inflation, because we don't have a lot of inflation right now. All right, let's talk about Tether real quick. So Tether is constantly being attacked by naysayers. There's those Tether haters out there that say the only reason why Bitcoin is pumped is because of Tether. All right. Well, they came out several months ago and we reported on this, I believe on FedWatch. If not, I have written about it on my newsletters. Check out bitcoinandmarkets.com and sign up for my newsletter there. But Tether came out with an audit, quote unquote audit, where they showed where their money is, what is backing Tether, because people are always saying that Tether's not backed one-to-one. Now, it came out in that audit that they had a sizable percentage of their assets in commercial paper. And that tweaked, or that piqued some interest, because that would be a very huge amount of commercial paper activity for Tether. And all the American big guys in the American commercial paper market didn't know this Tether entity. And so they did say that they're trading through proxies, but there's also a possibility that they were trading Chinese commercial paper. And that brings us into Evergrande and the huge credit bubble popping over there in China right now. Tether, it is possible that they are exposed to Chinese credit. And Tether would have a higher risk during these types of times where there's a huge collapse in economies. So this is the first time that I've really been, ooh, man, I've been a Tether supporter for years and years, but I think this might have something to it. I know they're very sharp guys. So if I saw this coming, they probably saw this coming in China and have diversified, or at least maybe moved their commercial paper, sold that and bought other stuff in the West or something. But it is a risk. And I think that does have, it does increase uncertainty in the Bitcoin space and can negatively affect the price. Okay, before we go, I just want to share my screen one more time with a chart, because I've been talking about this for a little while now on my newsletters, specifically my member newsletter. But if you look at the cycle in 2019 and this cycle that started in 2020, there are some eerie similarities. So if we just take this off, we'll take this moving average off too real quick. So you can just see this pattern of breakout from the 2019 low, went all the way to 14,000, had a consolidation period, had a lower high, and then Corona crash. And then if you fast forward to October of 2020, you see we broke out, we go race all the way up to 64,000, we roll over and we consolidate. Then we have a lower high, and now we're having a sell-off as if this were another corona correction. I mean, the fractal nature of this pattern is eerie. It is very eerie. And if we just look at this very specific area here, the second lower highs at both these periods. So this is January of 2020, and now in August, September of 2021. And then I'll put in the moving average. This is the 50-week moving average. You can see it struggled with that 50-week moving average, popped up over top, and then crashed. That's in 2020. And then 2021, we have a consolidation period, popped up over the 50-week moving average, and now is diving back towards that 50-week moving average and possibly might go below it. But we'll have to see. I don't think there's going to be a repeat of March of 2020 and the corona crash, but it is possible. I mean, there is a possibility that price crashes down back down to 30,000 again. I don't see that happening right now. I think 40,000 is extremely strong support, and all throughout the upper 30s is strong support. And so if there is a sell-off, most likely it's going to stop there. China has decoupled itself from Bitcoin. And that's a good thing for the Bitcoin price right now, because as China struggles here, it's going to have less of an effect on the Bitcoin price. So anyway, that's all I have for this episode, guys. I hope it is okay for me to go it alone this week. Christian should be back next week, and we'll jump into it. We're trying to get some guests on the show to interview. If you guys have some suggestions on guests that you would like to see interviewed for FedWatch in a Bitcoin-related way, get in touch on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @AnselLindner. Christian's is CK_Snarks. Bitcoin Magazine is @BitcoinMagazine. Check out my other content at BitcoinAndMarkets.com, and have a good weekend, guys.